Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 9:05 a.m. on Tuesday, May 4th, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative LeBon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl. And I don't see anyone else online. This morning we will hear House Bills 156, 157, and 182. First, House Bill 156, Industrial Hemp Program Manufacturing by Representative Hopkins. The committee last heard this bill on Friday, April 30th. Mr. Hardenbrook is here today to answer any questions from the committee. Does anyone have questions on House Bill 156 before we open public testimony? Seeing none, let the record reflect that we were joined by Representative Johnson at 9:05. With that, I will open public testimony on House Bill 156. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 156? Seeing none, is there anyone online? Looks like we have Ed Martin from Sterling. Good morning, Mr. Martin. If you'll state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony.
Hi, yes, ma'am. I can barely hear you, but I can hear you fine enough to testify. My name is Ed Martin. I guess maybe I just turned up my volume here. I'm calling on a cell phone. I'm from Sterling, Alaska. I'm a longtime Alaskan. I am very much in support of this bill. In fact, I believe that it's a requirement that the state come in compliance with the farm bill that was passed in 18, and there's deadline on this to get this accomplished. So, you know, I won't go elaborate how much I believe that it's a good bill for the state. State of Alaska, surely it's going to benefit families in the future that are in farming or want to get into farming. I believe there's a lot of land available from the state and the borough, local boroughs, to you know, enhance this program and make a means of revenue for the citizens of Alaska. And you know, I would encourage you folks in House Finance to continue to do the same kind of thing in other bills that are before you in this session, like the governor's permanent fund dividend program and trading that off for some land, and his 10-acre lease program or whatever. These are important bills that need to be done this year. This will add to the tax base, and it will benefit you know, the revenues of the state directly or indirectly, and or the local community. So please folks, time is somewhat urgent here. We shouldn't have to go into special session to do any of this. Get it moving along, and I appreciate the testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. We appreciate your testimony today. Is there anyone else online wishing to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. We have one new fiscal note from the Department of Natural Resources. If you look on the bottom right-hand corner, it is control code SUUYC. We have Mr. Shady from Department of Agriculture. Mr. Shady, could you place yourself on the record, please, and review the fiscal note? Mr. Shady, are you there?
Ah, now that I'm unmuted, Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thanks. My name is Dave Shady. I'm the director of the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources. So as the committee knows, this industrial hemp program is supposed to be set so that it's paid by the users, and so the fiscal note is set to reflect that the industry will be able to pay for that services and hopefully handles the problem that we had losing the receipts mid-year or mid-calendar year, where we have a switchover in fiscal year.
Thank you. Are there questions regarding the fiscal note? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Shady, for being with us today. Are there any further questions on House Bill 156? Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember a few years ago we were looking at this, and I remember that there was a regulation, and I don't remember if it was a state regulation or a federal regulation, that required that a marijuana grow couldn't be within a mile or two of a hemp grow, so it wouldn't cross-pollinate. Do you remember that, Mr. Hardenbrook?
Mr. Hardenbrook?
Thank you.
Remove your mask.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Representative Thompson, through the chair. The requirement that an industrial hemp grow be located a significant distance away from an Alaska licensed marijuana grow is continued to be contained in the regulations, and I think that Director Shady can speak to the specificity of the requirement there.
Director Shady?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thompson, through the chair, yes, we in our regulations, I believe it's 1,000 meters distance. So when you have a grow that's outdoors that is not for cannabinoids, the distance is not a particular problem. But if you're growing any kind of cannabis where you're worried about the flowering, that can be. So one of the things in our program we've set up is quarantine or distances, separation distances, so that there will not be problems with cross-pollination of the different kinds of cannabis. That will continue in the regulations as we move forward. It's definitely a state regulation, as the federal government does not recognize our recreational crop, and therefore anyone that would go and sign up for the USDA industrial hemp program would not have those requirements. One of the reasons why we're working to have Alaska to have its permanent program so that our people can be registered through our Alaska program, where we can internally make sure that we don't have problems between either industry.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shady, I was wondering who will be enforcing that and regulating it or watching it, and how much expense is that going to be to maintain that distance?
Representatives, through the chair, that's the Division of Agriculture. We register all users of industrial hemp. We work closely with AMCO, have their database of all their current registrants, and therefore it's kind of designed in a first-come, first-served basis. So the first outfit that's in play has that ground, and then we work to keep the separation distances in place. Now, as far as cost, it's minimal, as that is one of the criteria of an application is where it is, and it's pretty easy with GIS to take a quick look and see if we have any conflict. So it is part of our process now and will continue to be going forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for that clarification.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know the taxing structure is different, and I know cultivators of marijuana have to pay a tax per ounce, I guess. Hemp isn't like that. Is that there's no production tax to the state? I think we established that last meeting. I guess if someone were to, let's say, switch, let's say they were doing marijuana and said, hey, I'd rather switch to industrial commercial hemp. Is that a totally different licensure? And could someone do that or do both at the same time? Or is there some restriction saying if you're doing one, you can't do the other?
Mr. Shady?
Representative Wool, through the chair, that's a great question. In fact, we have some registrants that are registered with both AMCO and the division. Usually those different varieties are, of course, grown for different purposes, but we have no restrictions on either or both, so that we do have a number of groves that probably are going to go into the cannabinoid production part of it. Usually these are indoor groves. where you get into this to where they're doing both. But there is some challenges on the recreational side about the taxation to where the different companies, because industrial hemp is an agricultural crop, you can write off your expenses. And so the challenge is people, you know, the same grower are using different, legal entities to grow that. But we have no restrictions from the industrial hemp side for them being registered for both.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for that answer. I guess the next question is, if you're an industrial hemp grower, I'm assuming you don't have the same restrictions, i.e., people under 21, like your family, working with the crop or helping you harvest or do any of that. I know in with marijuana, they cannot be present or around the crop, but with hemp, is that restriction, I'm assuming, does not exist?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, yes, there are no restrictions. Again, it's an agricultural crop. It, by definition, does not have the THC and the risk involved with that. So, you know, if you're a family farm, you're not going to have the same restrictions. So, you know, that is one of the advantages of the industrial hemp program. We are in this bill, of course, raising, you know, the restriction on felonies, but we have not included any age restrictions in the language of this bill that you're considering.
Well, thank you. I didn't know about the felony raising. Can you slightly elaborate on that? Or if we did hear about it, I must have missed that.
Representative Wohl through the chair. For the record, Joe Hardenbrook from the Office of Representative Grier Hopkins. Yes, the Federal Farm Act of 2018 mandates that state-licensed industrial hemp programs prohibit the participation of an individual who has been found guilty of a felony involving a controlled substance.
Madam Chair, I can't hear anything.
10 years.
Thank you, Mr. Shady. Mr. Hardenbrook is giving an answer currently.
Thank you. Follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So that's complying with federal law, and even though, as Mr. Shady said, this is a agricultural crop, there's no restrictions on age and all this other stuff affiliated with marijuana, they're still treating it in a sort of drug world. If I want to grow wheat or barley, my felony wouldn't play into it at all. But if I'm growing this other agricultural crop, suddenly my past record will. So they are treating it in some ways like a drug-related crop.
Representative Wohl through the chair, Joe Hardenbrook from the Office of Representative Grier Hopkins. The 2018 Farm Bill transitioned industrial hemp away from a Schedule I narcotic and made it into an agricultural commodity. Part of the bill and the negotiations that were necessary in order to get the bill passed through the U.S. Congress resulted in the inclusion of a provision that anyone convicted of a controlled substance felony within the last 10 years would be ineligible for a license to participate in a state-licensed industrial hemp program. You are correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I see this adds two additional positions. Is that correct?
Representative Johnson through the chair. Representative Director Shady can speak to the ins and outs of the fiscal note.
Director Shady?
Yeah, I don't have that right in front of me. This is Dave Shady, Director through the chair. We had originally requested 4 additional inspectors and 3 people to work on that fund. So 2 to 4 depends on how fast the program grows. Yes, it will require additional staffing as the income coming into the program raises.
Mr. Hardenbrook.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, just to elaborate on that, Alaska Statute 0305010 mandates that the industrial hemp program be self-sustaining through fees charged on program participants. So if in the future the Division of Agriculture felt that they needed additional positions in order to fully run and manage the program, they would need to look to their schedule of fees in order to make that affordable.
Thank you, Madam.
Follow up?
Thank you. I guess my question would be then, through the chair to Director Shady, how many people are currently employed to oversee the industrial hemp program?
Representative, through the chair, we have one person hired. We have two positions that are authorized, but that is, you know, our dilemma has been on having the funding, so I hadn't hired that second person, and we definitely need a couple more inspectors right now. Once we can make sure we have that funding stabilized, we really, you know, we have one, and we'll hire as the money comes available, probably three more.
Thank you. Also then, so you, is the one person that's hired is being funded from industrial hemp sales?
Yes, ma'am. That person is funded from industrial hemp. However, my caveat is due to those funds being sweeped in July, I've, in starting it up, had to use general fund monies to set up the program and get it running. And my concern is because most of our fees are December, January based, then for at least some period of time in July, I have to put that position back on general fund as we then collect more industrial hemp fees.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this would be for the bill sponsor, I guess. Could we get a note on how any general fund monies that might need to be spent?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, the question is, would it be possible to get a note detailing how general fund dollars are spent in support of the program?
Yes. I mean, I don't know if there's a fiscal note or if it's just a little piece of research, but that would be appreciated, yes.
Sure thing. And Representative Johnson, through the chair, I think that what the situation described by Director Shady is that the industrial hemp pilot program's fees are assessed on a calendar year schedule, but the state fiscal year ends at the end of June. And so at the end of June, at the end of the fiscal year, all of the fees generated by the industrial hemp program are swept into the general fund. And so until they have, starting July 1, until they have additional registrants and fees brought in, they rely on general fund to pay the salary and the operating expenses until there are sufficient fees generated from the new fiscal year to start paying those costs.
And I think I understand that. It sounds like it may just be a replacement amount.
That is correct.
Who knows? Maybe the state's going to get more swept in and it's going out. I just wanted to have some clarity on that.
Absolutely. And again, Representative Johnson, through the chair, the statute is clear that the program must be supported through the fees generated from the participants in the program.
One more question then. This might be for the director. So the second position that's authorized, it's authorized because there's additional funds available in the hemp manufacturing program or hemp growing fees that have came in that allow for the authorization of that extra position.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, as part of the pilot program, the legislature authorized two positions. But I also assured the legislature that until I had confidence that we had the registration fees to carry this program, I would not hire those people. So I do have another position. I've just not been comfortable without carryover of those funds to hire that second position. So I'm comfortable that I can make it work with our first tech who does the registrations and all of that bookwork. But we need the carryover or designation of a dedicated fund such as LDIF, the Land Disposal Income Fund, where that bucket of money stays available for the program then we can grow the program without worrying about the sweep. So, you know, we have the issue of the positions, which I need about six positions really to run this program. But we have to have stability in funding, and that's part of that discussion of either carryover or setting up some kind of a dedicated fund. So, and I'm probably using the wrong term, fiscal term, but a fund such as LDIF where it is set aside for this program pursuant to statute.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shady, I was just wondering, back on the fiscal note, that it shows $106,900 of travel every year. Could you explain that amount of money for travel?
Representative, through the chair, absolutely. So we have retail stores in almost every village and town in the state. And as part of our tracking and registration, we do inspections. We go out, we pull samples, we make sure that the product that is out there is safe. And traveling throughout the state gets rather expensive. So to run a good solid program as part of our inspections for food, we will also, you know, tie in industrial hemp. And the program is supposed to pay its way. So when we have to travel out into different rural areas, you know, it's by air or by boat, and sometimes by charter. And so that's what we suspect to get out, and especially as we work to get another 2,000 registrants throughout the state into play, will require a good bit of travel as we get this set up in a permanent basis.
Follow up? Thank you. Mr. Shady, so these inspectors are not only inspecting on marijuana products in, I mean not marijuana, hemp products in retail outlets, they're also at the same time in that retail outlet inspecting other parts of the agriculture also?
Director Shady? Are you perhaps on mute?
I'm not hearing anything, Madam Chair.
Let me have Representative Thompson repeat his question.
Thank you. These inspectors that are going to be traveling, they're going to be traveling around inspecting more than just the hemp byproducts in a retail store, aren't they? Are they going to be inspecting other agricultural sides at the same time?
Representative, I heard literally the last 20 seconds.
Representative Thompson, you may remove your mask while you ask your question.
Thank you. I was just curious on this. When these inspectors go out to the retail outlets to inspect hemp products that are for sale, are they also inspecting other Department of Agriculture and Food and Drug inspections at the same time?
Representative, through the chair, we don't do quote-unquote food inspections. That's a purview of the Department of Environmental Conservation. But we will be looking at food. We do cool audits, labeling audits for produce and agricultural products. So, of course, as we go out, our inspectors will be trained to do industrial hemp, and over time our industrial hemp inspectors will be trained to do certain agricultural product inspections. So we do intend over time to blend that inspection team to where they can do all the different types of inspections. It definitely will be much more cost effective and not just cost one program or the other for the travel and for the work we do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Is there anything further? Seeing none, Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 156-32-LS-0741/B from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
Is there an objection? Seeing none, House Bill 156 is moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Next, we have House Bill 157, APOC Report Referenda Recall Contributor by Representative Rasmussen. The committee briefly heard this bill yesterday. Representative Rasmussen, if you and your staff, Crystal Kieneman, would like to place yourselves on the record and briefly reintroduce the bill, and then we'll take questions.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Representative Rasmussen, House District 22 in Anchorage.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Rasmussen.
And just to reiterate, House Bill 157 is a bill that aligns the reporting requirements for recalls and referendums with ballot initiatives as far as the APOC reporting requirements are concerned for timing.
Thank you, and let the record reflect, we were joined by Representative Edgman at 9:31. Are there questions from the committee regarding House Bill 157? Seeing none, we have Heather Hebdon online. If you could place yourself on the record and review the fiscal note.
Yes, thank you. This is Heather Hebdon, the Executive Director for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Under the fiscal note, we would anticipate increased workload, and currently the agency is pretty maxed as far as our capacity goes. So we would foresee additional workload related, including filer assistance and education, probably regulations that would need to be promulgated, as well as monitoring, auditing, and enforcement of the new reporting requirements. And this fiscal note calls for one additional paralegal that would oversee this area.
Thank you, Ms. Hebdon. Are there questions regarding the fiscal note? Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is to track and require reporting on contributions, et cetera, of a recall campaign or a referendum. If there are no recalls this year and there's no referendums this year, what is this one employee that's going to be paid money going to do?
Ms. Hebdon?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Thompson, this employee, even absent any recall or referendums, would likely be involved with other campaign disclosure requirements for the agency. Currently, we only have two dedicated staff members that oversee campaign finance disclosure for the state as well as 32 municipalities across the state. There would definitely be work available for this employee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Hebdon, as to the last comment you made, what did APOC have staff-wise relative to those assignments, say, 10 years ago?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I would have to look specifically at that timing, but since 2015, in 2015, we had 13 and a half full-time staff members. Of that, four people, I believe, were dedicated to campaign finance disclosure.
Right. Follow-up?
And you have what now, Ms. Hebdon?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, currently we have two dedicated staff members for campaign finance disclosure.
Follow-up?
May I take my mask off?
You may.
I want to make sure I understand you absolutely thoroughly, Ms. Hebdon. Let's do it this way. In 2015, how many staff did APOC have of any sort on any assignment?
We had 13, sorry, through the chair, Representative Josephson, in 2015, we had 13 and a half full-time employees.
Follow up. What do you have now?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, at this time, we have 8.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further? Seeing none, we will take this bill up at a later hearing, and I will have amendments due to my office tomorrow by 6 p.m. for House Bill 157. With that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Finally, today we have House Bill 182, Extend Fishery Resource Land Tax Credit by Representative Edgman. Representative, if you and your staff, Seth Witten, would put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 37 in Southwest Alaska. With me is my staff, Seth Witten. And really appreciate you and the committee hearing the bill. I think I can explain the bill in a couple sentences, which I will do, but it probably might be best if I offered some sort of context and some backdrop just to bring the full picture into view for the committee. What the bill does is it extends the fisheries resource landing tax credit that was put into place in 2014. Probably would have been extended last year in 2020, but we, of course, had a shortened session, so the bill now comes back before both bodies in an attempt to get it through this year. So that the tax credit itself is levied against a tax that was put into place in 1993. I think we all remember tutorial on the fisheries out in the Bering Sea. We probably are all familiar with the heydays of the crab industry and in the 1980s, the Mason-Stevens Act back in 1976, the opening up of the larger fisheries in the Bering Sea and so forth. Well, all this sort of came to a point in 1992, when the legislature said, there's a lot of activity out there, a lot of big boats that are out there fishing, but who are coming into shore, primarily in Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, and maybe a few other places, and using local services, but they're harvesting outside of the state-controlled waters, which is the 1 to 3 mile mark. So we think it's only fair that the state sort of gets some of that back, and so in a very contested vote, House Bill 264. I was a staffer back then, so tracking this very closely. The bill actually passed both the House and the Senate to create a 3.3% tax on the landings of all these big boats that were outside the 3 mile sort of state managed territorial waters. And the CDQ program came about in the early 90s, 92, 93. It's the North Pacific Council. And was later put into law by Congress back in 1996 and in 2006. So you've got this tax that was put in place in 1993. You've got the CDQ program coming together about the same time. In 2014, the legislature decided to create a tax credit program so those big boats that are out there fishing for the CDQ groups could actually contribute to nonprofit ventures, education, scholarship, training, things of that nature, and get a tax credit for it, just like we did for a whole host of other industries, including the oil industry and other tax credit beneficiaries. So this bill takes that program, that tax credit that started in 2014, that expired in 2020, and again, I think probably would have been re-upped had we had a full session next year, and it says, legislature, we think this program is running very well. Let's extend it to 2030, December 31st of 2030, and give it a chance to really sort of embed itself in the fabric of the CDQ program and their fishing partners, and really bring a lot of benefits to the tune of about $650,000 a year or so. and these benefits are being spread amongst 65 communities all along the coast in the Western Alaska that participate in the CDQ program, and it's been doing a lot of great things there. We have people online for whenever we get to public testimony that can speak, obviously, in more great detail to that. But that's the essence of the bill, with maybe a little backdrop that might have confused some of you, but I thought it might be necessary just to sort of put the full picture into view.
Thank you. Mr. Witten.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Seth Witten, staff to Rep. Edgman. The only thing that I would add is in the 2021 indirect expenditure report, indirect expenditure report by the Legislative Finance Division, they did state that the credit has met its legislative intent, and they recommended reestablishing the credit.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you, Representative Edgman, for bringing this bill before us. With not having a lot of background in this particular area, could you provide a little bit more information in relationship to where this tax credit is applied? I assume it applies when people are filing their federal income taxes. Is that where this credit is applied in the process?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, we might need to bring Department of Revenue in here at some point, but the tax is assessed. Part of the tax proceeds go to the municipalities, the other part goes to the state. And so the 45.45% tax credit limit itself, and we can maybe let revenue get into this sort of the why it's 45.45 and things like that. But that part comes out of the municipality's share. And beyond that, I think we probably should go to revenue.
We have Nicole Reynolds online, the Deputy Director, Tax Division with the Department of Revenue. Ms. Reynolds, can you place yourself on the record and help Representative Ortiz with this question?
Good morning. Nicole Reynolds from Department of Revenue, Tax Division. Representative Ortiz, through the chair, the CDQ credit is allowed for fisheries resource landing taxpayers who harvested fisheries resources under a community development quota. So they're allowed to claim this credit on their fisheries resource landing tax return when they're filing their return. So that's how it's applied. They file their return, and then they can claim the credit at that time.
Follow up?
And again, forgive my ignorance in this particular area. So the sponsor statement talks about how there was no revenue foregone by the state, but where that revenue foregone is, or where that revenue is lost, is at the municipality level then? Is that correct by applying this credit?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. So the CDQ credit reduces the municipal share of the fisheries resource landing tax revenue.
Follow up?
Final follow-up. And so the process then where this credit is actually applied, you say that they file their returns or they file their records. Do they do that when they're landing their fish and they're doing it at the processor stage then, or is it an annual thing that takes place when they go back and check all of their individual records for – can you tell me where it's actually applied? Thank you.
Through the chair, so this is an annual tax. The fisheries resource landing tax is an annual tax, and it is paid after the – statewide average price report has been posted in May. So that report comes out in May of the following year, and then the taxpayers file their returns at the end of the month of the month following the month that the report is posted. And at that point, the taxpayers will claim the credit on their return, and then on the return, the credit will reduce the municipal share of the tax proceeds.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Ms. Reynolds, while we have you on the line, could you go over the fiscal note, please?
Certainly. So through the chair, the fiscal note provides that in fiscal year 2022, we would expect about $1.16 million worth of credit, and the reason for that.
Brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. Ms. Reynolds, are you available?
Good afternoon. This is Nicole Reynolds, Department of Revenue, Tax Division. Through the chair, I apologize. I think I may have gotten disconnected there. So we were talking about the fiscal note for fiscal year 2022, and the amount shown there, the $1.16 million in credit value, that reflects a bit of a higher amount because we are anticipating 1.5 years of impact, and we assume that the impacts for the second half of fiscal year 2021 would be realized in fiscal year 2022. But in the out years, fiscal years 2023 through 2027, we anticipate somewhere between $795,000 to about $860,000 worth of credits. And we used our, actual fiscal year 2020 CDQ credits as a baseline and then just assumed a 2% annual increase in credit value.
Thank you, Ms. Reynolds. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Reynolds, is the number higher for FY22 because you're going to, even though the program expired, you're going to allow application to the program as if it didn't expire for a year?
Through the chair, so the bill has a retroactive effective date of December 30th, 2020. And so the bill would allow any contributions in calendar year 2021 to count for the credit. And so that's That's what that number in fiscal year 2022 represents there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and there's a lot to digest here. So if I have a CDQ, is it a permit? Would that be the right term to use?
It would, through the chair, would be fisheries quota.
Quota. So if I hold one, then my participation in this program is up to me as the holder of that quota?
Through the chair, technically speaking, the quota that is owned by the CDQ groups, I would submit, and maybe those online could verify, but 100% of them are probably being actively fished at this point. The CDQ program itself has grown to the point where, in its inception back in the early 90s, that quota was largely used in partnership with larger companies who had the bigger boats and who had the crews and expertise and what have you. But the program itself, which started some nearly 20 years ago, make that 30 years ago almost, now has gotten to the point where not only do they own the quota itself, which they were granted at the beginning of the program, but they have ownership in some of the larger vessels that actually harvest the fisheries. Some of the ownership rights in some fisheries, some vessels, may be full 100%. Others may be partnership oriented, and it's to the point now where the CDQ groups have really matured quite a bit. But the partnership that's in place with the harvesters that are non-CDQ oriented, which this bill addresses, and that ability to take some of those profits and get a tax credit for it, but to get those proceeds out into the villages of Western Alaska doing good things, has established itself as a very viable program. And so that's, I'm trying to bring this back to the essence of the bill with respect to your question, which I think is very, very good one.
Yep. Madam Chair, follow up. And I appreciate that answer. And I guess just looking at some of the uses of the landing tax credit would be scholarships for study, fisheries management, training in the state for employment in the industry, et cetera. So if I hold a CDQ and I land fish that's subject to the landing tax, then I have a decision. I'm at a decision point where I pursue the tax credit option and divert some of that tax to these different programs, or do I ignore that option? And then where would the landing tax revenue fall?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, I think you're doing a great job of queuing up some questions for the actual groups themselves to respond to.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Seeing nothing further, we will bring House Bill 182 up at a future hearing. And amendments for this bill will be due to my office tomorrow at 6 p.m. Thank you, Representative Edgman and Mr. Witten. We appreciate you presenting today. This concludes our agenda for this morning. I'm also going to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 19, which is Representative Christ Tompkins' language teacher certificate bill that we heard yesterday. That amendment deadline will also be tomorrow at 6 p.m. Our next meeting is this afternoon at 1:30, where we will hear an overview of the capital budget by the Office of Management and Budget. So with that, at 9:55, we are adjourned. Thank you. Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 1:33 p.m. on Tuesday, May 5th, 2021. I believe it is May 4th, 2021. And with that, present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. Today we will hear an introduction of House Bill 70, the Capital Budget. Neil Steiniger, OMB Director, is here with us. Thank you for being with us today. He's here to present this bill, so if you would come forward, place yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, Neil Steiniger, Office of Management and Budget. Thank you for inviting me here to speak about the governor's capital budget proposal. So for just an overview, there are capital budget items across several appropriation vehicles introduced by the governor this year. We have HB 70, which is the governor's standard fiscal year 22 capital budget. HB 71, which is the mental health budget, inclusive of mental health capital items. We also have several vehicles with fiscal year 21 supplemental items. HB 70 includes some supplemental capital items, so they're items effective in fiscal year 21. HB 68 represents what we had labeled as the fast track supplemental items, and HB 84 represents regular supplemental items. You can see here the high-level totals. In total for fiscal year 2022, we have just shy of $1.5 billion in capital projects, of which $62.2 million were funded with unrestricted general funds. In the fiscal year 21 supplemental items, we have a little over $142 million in total funds, but an actual net reduction in fiscal year 21 unrestricted general fund spending, which is a little bit of a misnomer here. That reduction is really a repeal of prior year capital projects that were completed, you know, on time and under budget, and those monies are then deposited into the Alaska Capital Income Fund. That deposit shows up as a positive in the operating budget, so that negative is netted out with a positive in the operating budget and then shows up in the capital budget as spending from designated general funds, primarily on deferred maintenance.
Thank you. And let the record reflect, at 1:34 p.m. we were joined by Representatives Rasmussen, Johnson, and LeBon, please. Thank you, Mr. Steiniger.
So slide three, and I have a couple slides here to talk a little bit about deferred maintenance. As you'll see in the capital budget proposals that we've put forward, a fairly significant sum of money dedicated to deferred maintenance. The reason for that really is the significant deferred maintenance backlog that the state faces. You can see here, excluding the university, the state has a backlog of just shy of $600 million. When you add in university facilities, it would be about $2 billion in deferred maintenance backlog. The reason we've excluded them is, you know, they track their deferred maintenance separately, and also it just would not show the scale of the distribution here nearly as well to add a $1.4 billion column. But you can see primarily most of the deferred maintenance backlog exists at the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and then Department of Administration, who manages a lot of the state's office buildings. And from there, you can see the agencies that have a greater number of facilities tend to have more of a backlog in deferred maintenance.
Mr. Steiniger, is there a breakdown for DOT on how much of it is facilities, as in buildings versus roads and bridges?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, or Chair Merrick, yes, we can get you that information. What is, you know, horizontal versus vertical deferred maintenance, if you will?
Yes, but thank you.
So addressed in across several appropriation vehicles, we've allocated just shy of $65 million in proposed deferred maintenance spending. You can see about $13.4 million of that was put in as fast track supplemental items. The reason for that is in fiscal year 21, there was no appropriation for deferred maintenance expenditures in the capital budget passed last year. So just knowing that a supplemental vehicle wouldn't pass early in the session, we allocated most of the deferred maintenance proposals into fiscal year 22. But just being aware of, you know, certain projects that could be started whenever a supplemental vehicle is passed, we did include some amount in that fast track supplemental budget. And we also have broken it down between statewide deferred maintenance, those are general state buildings, public building fund deferred maintenance, which specifically is a certain class of state buildings, primarily office buildings, and then court facilities as they're managed separately.
Thank you. Let the record reflect. At 1:37 p.m., we were joined by Representative Carpenter. Thank you, Mr. Steiniger.
So slide five is a snapshot of the overall fiscal year 22 capital budget by department. And you can see here the distribution of that about $1.5 billion, primarily being in the Department of Transportation with the Surface Transportation Infrastructure Program. You can also see a larger dollar figure in the other funds column than normally you would see in a capital budget. The reason for this is that part of our proposal was to utilize bonding through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to fund the state match requirements of the Surface Transportation Infrastructure Program, the Aviation or the Airport Improvement Program, as well as the Village Safe Water Program. So those are the areas with the most significant federal match on general fund dollar spending. And we chose to propose to use Alaska Housing Finance Corporation bonding in order to take advantage of low interest rates to meet a need of the state.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Steiniger, on either slide four or slide five is deferred maintenance for statewide schools within these numbers anywhere?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, so one thing to note about this presentation is we didn't actually include any of the general obligation bond proposals. We included the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation bond proposals because those were in the governor's standard capital budget. The general obligation bond proposal put forward by the administration did address school major maintenance. However, that wasn't in our normal capital budget. So while it's not reflected here in these slides or numbers, we did have a separate proposal to address that need.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Steiniger, the three categories for the HFC bonding, you said you listed three items. The last was Village Safe Water. What were the first two?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it was the Airport Improvement Program, the Surface Transportation Infrastructure Program, so the two main DOT capital programs.
Yep. And speaking of that, can you speak to what the STIP is? Because we often use that word, and I'm not sure if the viewers at home know what that means.
Thank you, Chair Merrick. The STIP, or the Surface Transportation Infrastructure Program, is the DOT program for highway construction. So that's building most of the roads throughout the state, or the DOT-owned roads throughout the state, and doing, you know, improvement projects on those roads. It has a 90-10 match, being that 10% is state funds and 90% is federal.
And can you say how projects are categorized or listed in priority on the STIP?
Chair Merrick, I'll give a kind of high level. I think, you know, DOT could give a lot more, you know, nuance to how that's done. They do have an annual process where they, you know, work through and rank projects and put them on the STIP, on that list with cost estimates. Those are, you know, sent to the federal government, to the Federal Highways Administration, and that list is reviewed at that level. And, you know, much more detail on that process, I think, would be best to go to the department.
And I do believe we're having the department come later this week. So Thank you. Please continue.
So to get into a little more detail of the actual projects by department, you can see here on this slide list projects for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. There are a couple, you know, primarily projects that we put forward this year in the standard capital budget were standard projects that are in capital budgets generally annually, things like community block grants or National Petroleum Reserve Alaska Impact Grant Program are projects that are recurring every year, appear in most capital budgets, and generally have a fairly generous federal to state ratio. You can see in community block grants a very significant amount coming from the feds with very little match required. There's not as many opportunities for discretionary capital spending, so you'll see that most projects really do rely on that federal match with a handful of projects that don't. I'll try to highlight those ones that are new and not recurring as we go through these slides. So in this slide, really a new item, it would be item three, the Alaska Marijuana Control Board Enforcement Case Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office case management system needs replacement, and they're using 50% general fund and 50% receipts of the organization. There's also an item eight is the Alaska Travel Industry Association. There's a $5 million grant. One thing to note on these slides is we're reflecting here the proposal that was put forward in December and subsequent amendments. Some of these items, like the grant to ATIA, may be something that would be accomplished through the plans that we've been working to develop for use of federal relief. So that discussion around the American Rescue Plan relief and using it for tourism marketing, you may have some of these discretionary items that could fit within those things that weren't known at the time this budget was developed.
Representative Foster, Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Regarding item number six, PCE, you've got $13 million for bulk fuel upgrades, and of course the PCE statutorily has the uses that it may be used for. You've got the waterfall. Originally it was intended to be used for just the Power Cost Equalization Fund. That's the energy assistance in rural Alaska. And then a few years ago we changed it to allow the PCE fund to be used for other things. The second item would be if there's money left over, then it can be used for community assistance. And then if you have extra money left over after that, then you can use it for renewable energy within AEA. And so bulk fuel upgrades, are you considering that to be part of the AEA's renewable energy, or is this outside of the scope of all three? What's your thinking on using PCE funds for this?
Yes, Chair Foster, the use of PCE funds for some of these AEA projects really was looking in the time period when this budget was put together and what we understood of the available amount of money in the CBR and available revenues to the state at that time, looking for fund sources to satisfy some of these needs that may be slightly outside of the statutory designation, but still fits within that concept of trying to move the needle on reducing power costs in the state. And so we felt, while it may not be a perfectly within those listed uses as you listed out, it still does fit to the intent of PCE. So that's why that fund source was chosen, just due to a unavailability of unrestricted general fund when this was being drafted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
On slide seven in the Department of Corrections, we have two new projects. One is for facility body scanners. This was a request put forward last year that wasn't accommodated within the capital budget when that was merged into the operating budget. This would allow for the installation of seven body scanners within correctional facilities. And then also the Port McKenzie Correctional Farm Produce Processing Plant. This will allow for them to use produce grown at Point McKenzie to be distributed to other prisons and used in the other prisons if they are able to process it there on site. In the Department of Environmental Conservation, you have four projects that are standard recurring projects within DEC, clean water, drinking water, and then the two components of the Village Safe Water Program.
Thank you.
Slide eight represents projects for the Department of Fish and Game. There are a couple of fisheries disasters, Pacific cod, as well as the 2018 sockeye salmon disaster. that are receiving federal receipts to address those fisheries disasters. Item three is for the Endangered Species Act. There's a combination here between both federal funds and a small amount of general fund match, as well as $750,000 of unrestricted general fund. So this is both for the state to do research for the possibility of species that may be considered for the Endangered Species Act, but also to do work funded by the federal government for, you know, dealing with species that have been placed on the Endangered Species Act. Items 8 and 9 here are the standard sport fish and wildlife management projects matched with Fish and Game Fund. And then we also, we have a couple of facility maintenance and improvement items here. Item 5 is the Copper River boat launch. And item 6 is coming from the Capital Income Fund, which we generally use for deferred maintenance. One thing here, this has been separated from the main deferred maintenance appropriation because that main deferred maintenance appropriation tends to focus on state facilities. And by giving a direct allocation to the Department of Fish and Game, they can use this to do maintenance on vessels and aircraft that often get left out of some of those discussions when you're talking about generally the vertical facility-based maintenance.
Please continue.
On page 9 in the Office of the Governor, item 1 is that main central allocation of money for deferred maintenance. It sits within the Office of the Governor so that we can prioritize projects across all state agencies. Every agency, or not every agency, but quite a few agencies have facilities, and so it's good to have this in a central spot so that we can make those prioritization decisions across different agencies and ensure that, you know, money is being placed to defer maintenance projects at the highest need of the state. Item 2 is a capital project for the Division of Elections to implement ballot measure 2. In the Department of Health and Social Services, we have several items that are not necessarily deferred maintenance but needed work at some of the facilities ran by Health and Social Services, including the Ketchikan Pioneer Home and the Palmer Veterans and Pioneer Home. The item 3 here, the Health Information Exchange, this is a longstanding program often called the High Tech Program, but this represents actually the last year of this program, so this will be the last time this appears in a state capital budget. We also have on item 9, may look a little odd, it's a reappropriation of capital projects from the Office of the Governor to the Department of Health and Social Services. Several years back, several IT projects were appropriated to the Office of the Governor, but they were IT projects for other state agencies, and that we found, rather than providing additional management oversight, has actually just slowed the process of getting those projects implemented. And so we're reappropriating that authority to the departments that manage them.
Thank you. Please continue.
Page 10 is the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. You can see the item 2 is the mass notification system for Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. This is half 50-50 split with the feds, $2.5 million in general fund match, matching $2.5 million in federal receipts. There's also the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson Digital Control Generator and Preventive Maintenance Program. This is to do much needed maintenance at that base. One thing to note, some of these maintenance items for DMVA are separately appropriated outside of that statewide group of money because the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs often is able to leverage federal receipts to do maintenance on their facilities.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As far as projects on military bases, in this case, JBEAR, I guess at what point is it because there's a state facility on this base, or at what point does the state pay for stuff on a federal installation?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, because there is a shared state responsibility with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, there are those facilities that they use as a state agency that are on the base, and there's that shared responsibility. You'll also see it in their operating budget, a shared responsibility for some of that maintenance. It can get a little complicated because some of that maintenance actually is, you know, completely paid for within the Department of Defense budget and doesn't flow through the state. So just sharing that facility on that base creates some complication in the way you see the maintenance. But in these cases, this represents the facilities that are our responsibility as a state, but have some shared costs with the feds.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
In the Department of Natural Resources, there is item one is a $4.5 million grant for a specialty agricultural crops. Items two and four are both mapping related. You have critical mineral mapping, which is now called Earth MRI, but previously was often referred to as 3DEEP. And then also geological mapping for energy development. Both of these use general funds to leverage federal match. There's also a cooperative water resource program that is a pass-through for stream gauging projects. Item seven is land sales and development of new subdivisions. This is utilizing state land disposal income, so the money that we receive when state land is sold, a portion of that can be used to promote the sale and manage the sale of new state lands.
Thank you. Please continue.
Continuing with the Department of Natural Resources, there's a federal grant for national recreational trails that is primarily federal funded, but also uses some of the Parks Division receipts. Item 11 is building new electronic fee stations. Previous appropriations for building electronic fee stations has shown some successes in being able to generate fees without as much involvement by park staff. And there are two different purchases, the Kenai River Bookie Parcel purchase and the Eagle Rock Bookie Parcel improvements using EVOS funds, Exxon Valdez oil spill settlement funds. In the Department of Public Safety, similar to in Department of Fish and Game, you know, separating out appropriations for maintenance of the vessels that they have in the Marine Fisheries Patrol improvements as some vessel maintenance. It's also funded by federal receipts. There's equipment replacement at the crime laboratory. This is necessary equipment to ensure that it is, you know, up to date and providing, you know, adequate evidence for cases. There are also some equipment replacement items for both wildlife troopers and state troopers to replace worn or outdated equipment used in the field.
Thank you. Please continue.
In the Department of Revenue, these nine items here all are through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. These are a variety of housing-related programs, both rental relief and assistance, teacher and health housing, housing programs for seniors, as well as energy efficiency or various grants for different specific housing-related items.
Thank you. Please continue.
Item 14, another three Alaska Housing Finance Corporation related housing programs or energy efficiency programs as well. In the Department of Transportation, the third year of the computerized maintenance management system or CMMS of $1.5 million in unrestricted general fund. This software system is what is used to actually categorize and rank maintenance of state facilities and informs that decision on the $49 million appropriation to the Office of the Governor for statewide deferred maintenance. We also have several way stations that need repair and replacement. as well as $15 million in our kind of normal annual costs of vessel overhaul for the Alaska Marine Highway System.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to flag a couple of things here, and I'm not, I don't want to belabor them, but on slide 13, the HFC Supplemental Housing Development Program, I've gotten concern registered that is underfunding the program in a sense that it's a program that the housing authorities and others are able to leverage very effectively. And so to fully fund that returns a considerable amount of work and effort to the housing authorities. And then the second one is number 10, the energy program's weatherization. We're not in a perfect world. We're challenged for money these days. But boy, if in an ideal world, that would be a lot higher, because that's a program that returns a tremendous amount of value in terms of jobs, economic development, and 30-40% savings in homes across the state in terms of energy costs. So I just want to put that on the record for now. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Just a follow-up for Representative Edgman on the weatherization program. Can you recall in years past what that funding level was at? Is that when we had more UGF available?
Through the co-chair, yeah. Back in 2008, 2009, we had $300 million in there. That's when oil was at 146, 147. And we got to where we're about, I'm going to guess, maybe 15% of the homes in the state weatherized. But in my region, our housing authority, tremendous, tremendous value. A lot of older homes out there, and local jobs, just tremendous value for the bang on the buck.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could go back to slide 12 with your indulgence on public safety in the budget subcommittee, we looked at a request for nearly $1.5 million for vehicles, radios, other safety equipment items that the subcommittee declined to fund in the operating budget. So is this to offset that action, and this to put something in for those items? Is there connection to that action?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, there's no connection to that action, but I would say there is a bit of a connection to that original proposal. So addressing how we manage the cost of replacement of worn-out equipment for troopers and wildlife troopers, it is something that could be considered an ongoing operating cost. Here you see an amount of money that would allow them to kind of catch up with some needs. That proposal to add it into the base budget would have allowed them to just kind of bake it in as an annual operating cost.
Follow up.
So I guess if the subcommittee had approved $1.5 million, we wouldn't see $500,000 here today. You don't have to answer that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please continue.
I believe we were on to slide 15, which is a continuation of the Department of Transportation. Here you can see the airport improvement program that we discussed earlier, as well as the STIP. Items 6 and 8 are the federal receipts on that. The state match is represented on 9 and 10. You can see here those are listed as AHFC bonds. The use of AHSC bonding requires passage of a separate bill to authorize the issuance of those bonds. You can also see here we have a couple of other standard projects, such as the International Airport Systems project, as well as federal emergency projects and Federal Transit Administration grants. One thing to note on item 14, not reflected on this, is a late amendment we put forward yesterday that would raise that $10 million because that grant has increased in amount. Oh, to $30 million.
Thank you. Please continue.
Continuing on with Department of Transportation, there's a mental health coordinated transportation project that is annual reoccurring in the mental health budget. Item 18 is for the Anton Anderson Memorial Tunnel and Portage Lake Tunnel capital improvement using toll receipts from that tunnel. And then there's also reappropriation of capital projects from DOA to DOT. These represent capital projects on public building fund buildings with the proposed shift of the public building fund management to DOT. We need to reassign some of those older capital projects that are not yet complete so they can be managed by Department of Transportation. And you also have one request from the court system for statewide deferred maintenance of court-owned facilities.
Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry to going back again here, just trying to keep up. On slide 13, it was my understanding, and correct me if there's another funding source or I'm just way off base, the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks is located near the University of Alaska. I thought there was money funded into that program, and I don't know if the funding source was AHFC, but that's what I recall hearing.
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, I believe at one point they received AHFC funding directly to the cold climate housing. I would have to get back to you with some more details on the funding history on that.
Follow up?
And maybe what I'm going by is more hearsay than fact, but I was left with the understanding that the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation dividend included a carve out for the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. So that's the basis of my question. So if you could help me with that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, I can get back to you in writing.
Thank you. Please continue.
So moving on now to some of the fiscal year 2021 capital supplemental items. The table on slide 18 gives you the high-level view by department of supplemental capital requests. Again, the negative amounts are reappropriations of completed capital projects that were completed under budget, with those funds primarily going to the Alaska Capital Income Fund to support deferred maintenance projects. On these slides, what we're showing here are only outstanding supplemental capital projects that were not incorporated into the committee substitute of HB 69 that included quite a few of the governor's supplemental requests. So here we're highlighting the items that were not included in that committee substitute. In the court system, there is deferred maintenance of just over $1.5 million for court system buildings. In the Department of Fish and Game, there was $500,000 to cover facility, vessel, and aircraft maintenance, as well as $5.9 million for just general statewide deferred maintenance. As I mentioned earlier, you know, this amount is significantly less than was included in the fiscal year 2022 budget. That was just, you know, to account for the fact that we would only be able to deploy a small amount of the deferred maintenance money in the timing provided once a supplemental bill passes. However, there are some, you know, more urgent deferred maintenance needs or items that could be, you know, benefited by starting prior to July 1st. On slide 20 in the Department of Law, there's a $4 million capital project for prosecutor recruitment and housing. This is related to the increase in prosecutor positions in the fiscal year 22 budget to allow for advanced recruiting of those staff. In military and veterans affairs, there were several items included in the fiscal year 21 budget request last session that were not included in HB 205 due to the truncated session last year. And so we've put those forward again as supplemental items. Most of them are maintenance related for DMVA facilities, such as the Bessel Readiness Center, the Kotzebue Readiness Center, statewide roof repairs. And then there's also a reappropriation from the Department of Administration. This is for the Alaska Land Mobile Radio. There are some outstanding capital projects. That program has moved from DOA to DMVA. And so those projects just need to be trued up and moved over to where they're managed.
Thank you. Can you, regarding the Department of Law, give the justification for using higher ed funds for the prosecutor, housing, and recruitment?
Chair Merrick, when we put together the fast track supplemental bill where this was included, one thing we were looking to do was to avoid using unrestricted general funds just to kind of help move it through the process, since there were several urgent needs in that budget. So in the interest of not using dwindling unrestricted general funds or really CBR funds, especially because at the time we had a projection on the CBR of, getting near the lowest possible balance that we'd like to see in that fund, we looked to other funds that might have available balances to meet some of these needs. So we're not trying to draw any kind of connection between the purposes of the higher education fund and this need to address sexual assault. It just was an available fund source that could satisfy this need.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a quick question. What's a readiness center?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, in terms of it as a term of art, I might actually have to ask DMVA how that is different from their what their different types of their facilities around the state, if that is a specific type of facility, aside from like a barracks or something else that they may have. But my understanding is that these are their facilities around the state for members of the Guard to, convene for, training or other activities. I just don't know if there's more meaning to that term of art.
Thank you. Please continue.
On slide 21, in Department of Natural Resources, there is a request for $3.25 million to assess landslide hazards. This is particularly to allow for advanced warning of events should a landslide occur and cause a tsunami. In Department of Revenue, there's a reappropriation of a prior year capital project. The reappropriated funds would be used for tax expertise and economic impact analysis of any tax proposals that may come forward. And in Department of Transportation, as I've mentioned earlier, there are reappropriations of unexpended balances on capital projects that came in under budget.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Steininger, going back up to your natural resources, Alaska landslide hazards, is that kind of an annual request and an annual appropriation that the state looks for, maybe from some different sources, but generally do we try to cover that potential, or is this something specific to something that's happened recently?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, this is a specific item. This isn't an annual reoccurring cost. And I'll have to apologize. The specific region, I'm failing to bring that name to my head. Sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Steininger.
And that is the conclusion of my slides.
Are there questions for OMB regarding the capital budget proposal? Seeing none, thank you for being with us today, Mr. Steininger, and we'll take a brief at ease. Go after that. Sorsha?
seconded?
Nope. Everything else is going to be last tomorrow.
Okay, maybe after, if DOT doesn't take that long, maybe we could try to schedule that. Okay. Huh? You guys are getting off easy.
Okay, I can come up with my banking bill and.
Maybe you can just give us a banking bill
for
the day.
It would be the, you know, the opening summary
a for third bill.
Or my line of credit bill, or my.
Is that HB 85?
Yeah, I think it's being heard Thursday.
Thursday.
I could wait.
All right, we will hold with breath.
In anticipation.
And I see no further questions from the committee, so we will set House Bill 70 aside for today, and tomorrow we will continue this discussion with a presentation from Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So this concludes our agenda for the afternoon. Our next meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, May 5th at 9:30 a.m., and I just want to confirm that that's 9:30 and not 9 a.m. 9 a.m. Our next meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, May 5th at 9 a.m., where we will hear House Bill 155, which is court system provide visitors and experts, and HB 110, which is age for nicotine e-cigarettes and tax e-cigarettes. So with nothing else to come before the committee, at 2:14 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.